everybody. Welcome to the Janet Foster Show, where you get real talk that you can act on. Today, we are going to take on a very heavy topic. And just for any parents that are listening that have young children in earshot, this is today's discussion is for mature audiences only. Certainly, if you have a teenager that is in high school, this is probably an appropriate time for a parent to sit with their teen. And certainly, if you think that your teen is very mature, to take on this topic. And today's topic is dealing with sexual assaults in America and basically addressing the rape culture in America. The reason why I'm taking on this topic, and I think it's something that there are just some things that need to be said. And I think the right tone that needs to be said. I have two guests today that I think bring the appropriate tone to this subject. And this is also a multi-part series that we will have here on the Janet Foster Show. And as always, I'll give you, give parents definitely kind of a heads up. But this is an important topic in the sense that it's something that we all hear about, but we generally don't, we don't know all the ins and outs. And the only people that actually do is when this occurs to them. And so we want to not only empower survivors, and I will always refer to a sexual assault individuals who have been violated that way as survivors. They are no one's victim. And one of the things that I want to just ask our audience today, if you have any thoughts or questions, definitely get social with me on Facebook. The Facebook page is Janet Foster, and you can definitely air your thoughts there. Also, you can get social with me on Twitter and Instagram, and that's at Janet D. Foster, and that's D for Deborah. And also, if you could, hashtag JFO Show. That's JFO Show. And today's guests that I have, they are what I prefaced was they definitely bring the right tone. And before we get into that and I introduce them to you, I just want to give you a little insight on the world of basically. I want to let you know how this particular subject has come about and why it should have more importance in discussions, not only among us as citizens, but our politicians need to do a much better job. There is some sensitivity when things are brought to their attention, but oftentimes they react to things. And then there are some great nonprofits and lobbying groups that do very well at getting funding. But what seems to be a strong disconnect is between law enforcement at where a survivor is dealing with law enforcement and also where a survivor has to interact with the healthcare system. There is a deep disconnect between that. Public policy in some states, as I've researched, some states have done a good job at reacting to things. But again, in terms of coordinating and actually seeing if their coordination is correct, there's a huge disconnect. And some of the disconnect that we've researched here at the Janet Foster Show, we've found that there's a case in Illinois, and there's a case of where one person openly shared. And this has happened multiple times, where in Illinois, that particular state, they do have a voucher system for sexual assault survivors. And basically, this voucher system is supposed to pay costs for up to 90 days. And it's hospital costs related to the actual incident within, you know, up to 90 days, which on paper, that sounds great. But where the disconnect is happening sometimes is in the billing. There's a billing problem. And, prior to me getting on this show and bringing this show to the public, you know, my career has been in the healthcare industry, both on the medical side as well as with insurance companies. And I can tell you that hospitals, particularly, they are very aggressive about their billing. And if they don't get paid, they actually will go to the person that receives services. So there's an individual in Illinois, and there's cases in Illinois where some sexual assault survivors are being what the healthcare industry calls balance billed for services that they're not responsible for. And sometimes if there's a disconnect with the billing with the state, these bills actually fall into collections. And generally, insurance companies usually jump right in and stop hospitals, but hospitals have become much more aggressive these days in balance billing and putting people in collections. In some cases, they've been doing it within 30 days of services. So that's a disconnect just in that state. And then also recently in Louisiana, a hospital, it was a state-run hospital, which was funded by the state, which also meant that they complied with their particular state's requirement as it applied to rape kits. And basically, no one should be paying for that. And in essence, in most states, you don't pay for that because it's the actual evidence collection kit. But in Louisiana, a state-run hospital, which changed hands, it was bought by a private hospital company. All of a sudden, that hospital started billing sexual assault survivors for those rape kits. And that's something, again, where they are balance billed, and a lot of times that they are thrown in collections. Another thing with sexual assault survivors, and this is a point of contention that I seem to have consistently researched, of the cases of sexual assault that have been reported, a lot of women use their private insurance to take those costs. Now, as a citizen, I don't think you should have to pay that one bit. This is a responsibility. I think it's a public safety issue. And I think that not only the city, the county, and the state where the incident occurred, they should take more liability because they should beef up their not only security in that area, but also their ability to trace offenders. And we're going to get into some of the statistics of the offenders. I don't think any woman, child, or even men, because there are men who are sexually assaulted as well, no one should be using their private insurance. And I'm going to tell you why. And this is based on my previous professional experience. One thing that happens with a claim is based on how something occurred, that bill goes into your insurance. And if it's your employer, and nowadays, especially with a lot of companies complaining about having to comply with the Affordable Care Act, some employers are asking for their utilization, which according to privacy laws, they really can't have that. But potentially on claims information, people can detect, because a lot of companies, they do get utilization information, and they can be able to identify what services are being given. They may not know by name, but they may be able to detect who was sexually assaulted based on the ICD-9 codes. Coming up, it'll be ICD-10. But there's a lot of privacy at risk, and that's one reason why I don't think anyone should be using private insurance for something like this. Also, a second telltale is pharmacy utilization, because after something happens like that, and for those reported cases, usually a survivor is monitored for sexually transmitted diseases. And of course, one of the fatal sexually transmitted disease is HIV. And that kind of medication on your insurance shows up as who's getting that. And that, again, is something that you should not be penalized because your law enforcement agency has not been able to prevent something. I do think that there needs to be more assistance in that area. And I know I'm editorializing, and I'm editorializing based on facts and data that I've seen that I just find utterly ridiculous. And then because I'm a woman, I'm a little sensitive to this, to know that potentially I'm at risk for something like this happening. Just want to give you that perspective. And one perspective I want to give you is just on just as the population as a whole, based on racial demographics, based on women. Now, a lifetime of reported either attempted rape or completed rape, there have been 17.7% white women in the United States who are survivors of that act. There are 18.8% black women who are survivors of that type of attack. The largest group that just blows me away is the American Indian, Native Americans, and Native Alaskans. 34% are survivors of that attack. And mind you, these are all just reported cases. Also, individuals that are of mixed race, and that can be of also multiple ethnicities, 24% of women are survivors who have reported this incident. And then Asian Pacific Islander, which has the lowest, is 6.8%, which I actually think that it very well could be even higher. There are some cultural issues in terms of reporting and other things in terms of other things that are beyond, I think, what other demographics here in the U.S. at what we deal with that. But I just want to let you know, just to give you that perspective of the percentage of women. And just last year, there were over 17.7 million women who have survived either a completed rape or an attempted rape. And that's just women. Also, men are 3% of the U.S. population that have reported either an attempted rape or a completed rape. And children under the age of 12, they comprise 15% of all cases of reported attempted rape or completed rapes. And of that, 3% are boys in grades 5 to 8, 5% are boys grades 9 to 12. And just to give you even a larger perspective, every 8 minutes, a child protection services, the various agencies throughout the United States, responds to a report of either suspected or substantiated sexual abuse of a minor. And interesting and a very alarming, 82% of juvenile assaults are female, and girls aged 16 to 19 are 4 times more likely to be assaulted. And one of the things that I want to bring to this audience is, you know, we're in fall time right now, and a lot of parents are dropping off their daughters. Aunts and uncles are going with their nieces, cousins, dropping them off at college campuses. And, you know, when you think about someone, you know, 17, 18 or 19, they could be freshmen in college. And, you know, they could be a part of that 82%. And you think about that. And just another thought, 68% of sexual assaults go unreported. And as a result of that, even of those, I think the 68% and what in research that we found, a lot of it has to do with attitudes here in the United States about sexual assault survivors, whether things come to mind, maybe it was something she wore. She was asking for it. Maybe she was somewhere where she shouldn't have been, or, the guy was married, just all kinds of crazy things that actually cause difficulty for survivors. And it's a wrong way of thinking. And we want to take that on. And here's another thought for you: of even the cases of sexual assault that are reported, only 2% of rapists are ever convicted. So all of the burden seems to be on the victim, from evidence collection with even complying for getting a rape kit, just reporting it and then going and enduring, whatever red tape that's involved to report how you've been violated, and then to actually deal with the evidence collection, which you ultimately are responsible for it, whether your state has funding for it or not. And just to give you another perspective on what states offer, every state in the U.S. and the District of Columbia does have what's called a victim assistance fund. Consistently, that's what it's called. Some states call it something else, whether it's violent crime, but they all come under that heading of they do provide some funding. For the most part, that dollar amount usually is a flat amount up to a maximum amount. And for the majority of the states, it's $1,000. And I can tell you right now, just the pelvic exam that's used, that actually survivors have to go through, that in itself can run you about $700. That does not include any of the medication. Just like I talked about the risk of sexually transmitted diseases, when you think about HIV, they do have to put you on a preventative cocktail. And I can tell you right now, there are no drug companies that are offering that as a free thing for survivors of sexual assault, which means either women are using their own private insurance if they're fortunate enough to have a job, and women who are of means that they don't have, they can basically pay cash for everything. They're either doing that, and that's where we need to deal with public policy and talk a little bit about this. Now, before we get into some of the details with our survivor, I'd like to speak with our first guest. Her name is Lisa Miller, and she is from a group out of the Dallas-Fort Worth area called Hope Rising. Lisa, are you there?
I am.
Great. Thank you so much for being able to join us today for such what I call a necessary subject. And one of the things that I am so impressed with your group, Hope Rising, is how you've been able to address just various, I think, various needs for survivors. You not only do work, fundraising work through the arts for sexual assault survivors, but you also work with other groups that work with other issues, that I think that are also important to the public. But I want to have you share your group's mission, and perhaps we may have someone listening who wants to get involved after hearing where a lot of these public programs fall short financially for survivors, that maybe what your group is doing to fundraise, that they can kind of mirror what you're doing in their own community. But I'd really like for you to share with our audience about the good work that Hope Rising is doing.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for having me on. Hope Rising, we started about 5 years ago, and it started exactly with the Vagina Monologues, which is where a lot of groups start. We finished that project as well as participating in the 1 Billion Rising flash mob the very first year. Mm-hmm. And through that, the girls got together and they said, we can do so much more. and talking to the Turning Point Rape Crisis Center and Hope Store and so many other organizations in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, we discovered there was a huge need for this. A lot of the funding that these organizations get through the government and through the state is earmarked. It has to go to a certain thing, whether it's someone's paycheck or to a hospital service, et cetera. But what the funds that we give them can go towards anything they need. If they need to buy clothing to go with the same nurses to the hospitals, if they need to buy shampoo to go in the domestic violence shelter, they can buy whatever they need. And a lot of times they'll call us. Last year, the domestic violence shelter had a huge flood, and they needed to replace some of the flooring in the facility, in the house itself. And we all gathered together, and we got online, and we raised enough, you know, we raised several thousand dollars for them to be able to do that. This year, the Turning Point Rape Crisis Center, their air conditioning died in their yoga studio. And yoga is something that's really important to the survivors, isn't that they, it's a therapy. And they need that air conditioning in the state of Texas. So we've put together a campaign, and we're trying to raise the funds to fix that air conditioning in their yoga studio. So there's all kinds of, you know, little needs that these organizations have that they just can't find the money for. And that's where we try to step in and go, we'll figure it out. Let us do this. And our goal is mainly to do it through the arts. Too many of us with Hope Rising are too empathetic. I admire Dawn and so many of the SANE workers that work with the Turning Point. And that they can sit and hold someone's hand or they can answer the phone. Well, there's too many of us that are survivors that are just way too empathetic to be able to do that. But we can entertain and we can put on a show and we can tell the public what's going on through that avenue. And that's what we do. So we do shows a couple, three times a year. We're getting ready to do a show called Love, Lost, and What I Wore by Dylan Nora Ephron. And this will be a benefit for Hope Store during Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And then come April, we'll do the Vagina Monologues again, and we'll also do another flash mob. So
excellent.
That's what we do.
Excellent. And it seems like just based on the work that you're doing, I like how your organization is supporting a lot of these local nonprofits. And just as you said, a lot of them they get funds that are earmarked. And for our listeners, just so that you know, particularly in the case of rape crisis centers, whether they are local to you, a lot of times the states and through our research, we found a lot of states and even local municipalities actually depend on rape crisis nonprofits to deal with the entire situation or deal with the needs of the survivor. And generally, there is a kind of a handoff to that. And groups like Hope Rising, I think, are just so essential to fill in those gaps. I know I talked about medication and things like that, but something that Lisa mentioned, when the physical structure sometimes inhibits being able to provide some kind of need that they provide for survivors, that becomes something that's difficult to handle. And I think what's so creative is that they create an outlet for not only performers to be a part of finding a solution in their own community, but also it gives the public, I think, the opportunity at large to learn about who's taking care of individuals in need in their community. And also, one of the things that people should also think of is when you're doing things like this, a night on the town of theater, it's tax deductible. So definitely groups like Hope Rising is something that we want to make sure that our listeners are are apprised of that can be an option? Because sometimes people want to help, but maybe they are too, they're afraid to be on a phone line to take a call from someone who is, who's hurting, and they may not know what to say. This is another way. And Lisa, for those groups that want to reach out to Hope Rising, and for those individuals that want to reach out to Hope Rising, say they want to set something up in their own community, or we do have listeners in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, how can they get involved?
Look us up online, hoperisingtx.org is our website. And then we also have a fairly large Facebook presence that we keep all of our events online as well. If I can add to that, the
please,
theater and dance and just the fine arts in general have a way of reaching out and touching the public and the individual's souls that's just completely different than a talking head standing up on stage and going, we got to do this and we got to do that and pounding their fists. Whereas when you're doing something with the art, you can really make someone think and really reach them in a completely different manner than is available through the other avenues. And that's what we strive to do, you know, tell stories in a way that's completely different than what you see every day and in the newspaper and in the news. To put a face to it and a voice to it is just really life-changing. And that's what we try to do. And I think any organization that anybody who's looking to organize anything in their community, just give us a call and we'll help you out. We'll tell you where to go and how to find the resources for it. But yeah, we help several even smaller organizations. There's Ashley's Patients Project that's in Bonham, Texas. She works with legislation trying to change that, and her focus is more domestic violence, but she's got a huge presence, and we're trying to help her launch with her 501c3 and get her going and keep her going. And then there's another organization called I Will Stand International that has what they call an invisible village all across the United States. It's actually international, that they can hide these women in anybody's home. It's very much like the Underground Railroad, that they can hide them and move them throughout the country. And it's just phenomenal what they do, and they just don't have all of the funding that these, you know, the state and so forth can give them. So, and then also the Turning Point and Hope's Door and all of those organizations that are really established in the community, when they go to the government and the state for funding, a lot of that funding has to go to education. So helping the survivors is a whole different side of it, that, you know, the money that we raise is the money that goes towards those sweatpants and the sweatshirt to change into after you've had that exam at the hospital, or a toothbrush just to be able to brush your teeth is just, it's a phenomenal thing. So all of that, all of those funding, all of the funding that we raise is what goes towards those things. So it's really important. It can be really helpful to those groups too.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And listeners, that's hoperisingtx.org, hoperisingtx.org. And if you can hold on the line, we are going to speak with our survivor, Dawn. Dawn, are you there?
I'm here, Janet. How are you?
I am very well. And thank you so much for joining us today. And to our listeners, we are only sharing Dawn's first name, and it is an alias. We want to protect her privacy, but at the same time, I want to thank her because she is the bravest person I have ever met, and she's also someone who is one of the fiercest activists for this cause, and the cause is just bringing an awareness of the disconnect for the survivor, kind of walking in the survivor's shoes. And I must say, what you've shared with me not only got me riled up just as a woman, and it was very, I have to say, it was very challenging for me as a reporter to research a lot of information. But I'm so glad that you're here. And I'd like for you, as much as you'd like, Please share with us your story as well as what you're doing to advance, I think, and address America's rape culture.
Sure, and I appreciate you inviting me to be on the show. So I was raped actually twice, and I was raped at the age of 18. This was in about 1982. It was by a coworker. And like many people choose, I chose not to report it. You know, it kind of turns your world upside down. I just didn't have any experience with it. I didn't really know who to turn to. And when I found myself raped again at age 49, because of some things I found out about my prior rape, namely that the person who sexually assaulted me went on to rape three other women and actually was finally arrested, I was determined this time to do everything that you're told to do. So I reported it to the police. I was initially treated with respect and did everything they told me to do. I went to the emergency room. I had a 4 or 5 hour rape kit examination, and that, as you described, is a very personal, very invasive exam. Most survivors submit to it in the hopes that it will help catch and or prosecute their rapist. And in my case, I knew the person who raped me because they were an acquaintance. So it just can help to prove that an assault took place. And unfortunately, for many survivors like me, you know, you receive a bill in the mail, and it kind of takes your breath away, and makes you a little bit angry. And I called the hospital, and I said, I'm absolutely not going to pay this. It was eventually submitted to collections. As you discussed earlier, you do have the option of going through your insurance, which a lot of people don't want to do because of privacy issues. And you can submit paperwork to a victim's compensation in the state of Texas. However, I didn't really want to relive it once more. When you're sexually assaulted, you have to describe your assault to the initial police officer. You have to describe it to the person at the counter when you're being triaged in the emergency room. You have to describe what happened to the emergency room physician, the nurse, the sane nurse, the advocate, the detective who follows up. So you're retelling this story over and over again, and I just didn't want to have to retell it again. So I decided that I was not going to pay that bill just on principle, and it went to collection. So it's actually like a mark against my credit. So I over the past year, have become a very adamant and vocal activist on this subject. I think there's a lot of myths about sexual assault that pervade the whole system, and I think there's a lot of room for education so that sexual assault victims are dealt with in a fair and dignified manner. And that is now my focus. And going forward, I would just say to other people not to be ashamed to talk about this, that it's not your fault, and that shame often keeps people silent and makes them, not come forward, not talk about it, and not speak out to so that people see, hey, I know somebody who was sexually assaulted. And I think when you put a face on sexual assault, people realize it's not just something that happens to other people. It's something that can happen to your friends and your family.
Absolutely. You bring up an excellent point about putting a face on it. And also to your point about the word shame, I'd like to talk a little bit about that, because there's in all of the research that I've conducted prior to today's discussion, that the word shame seems to be an overwhelming theme based on all survivors that they bring up. And some talk about it initially. And I kind of want to talk a little bit more about how it seems our society, how our society is behaving. I mean, we have in some states where there are state legislatures where they're on the floor talking about legitimate rape versus whatever, however they're trying to define it. And not only is that offensive, but it's even more offensive when it's coming from a man. And, you know, do you have any thoughts on how just you are so strong? Do you have any thoughts or just any kind of encouragement for someone who's listening now? Since we know, you know, 68% of sexual assaults go unreported. There, you know, there's someone that there's at least, I say we've got a large audience that we've got people who are listening that never reported. Is there something that you can say as a survivor to just give them encouragement?
Absolutely. I'd like to say something about that and then just address some of the things that you said also.
Sure.
You know, I would say if you feel like you're not being treated appropriately or fairly by the police, I would advise speaking to a lawyer for advice, or asked to speak to your district attorney. You know, one barrier to prosecution of sexual assault is we often require rapists, rape survivors, and rapes to fit a narrative about rape in order to believe survivors. Things like a rapist is a stranger who grabs a victim in a dark alley. It's not a friend or an acquaintance, when actually, according to all statistics, you know, that I've read, about 82% of sexual assaults are perpetrated by a non-stranger.
Yes.
Rape survivors are often believed to be dishonest and that they make false accusations of rape, when actually false reports are as uncommon and occur no more often than false reports do of other crimes. Myths like men cannot be raped or they should be able to fight back to stop it, that rapists look or act like monsters, therefore ordinary people we know can't be rapists, that victims, real victims, fight back ferociously instead of deciding to comply due to fear for their safety or their life, that survivors always sustain serious or life-threatening injuries, that they always report rapes immediately, although many survivors never had the strength to talk about it to anyone, and that survivors who decide to file civil suits are lying to extort money, although civil suits may be their only legal recourse left because often their cases are mishandled and they don't get justice in criminal court. So, you know, the lack of prosecution does not mean that a rape didn't occur. You know, police officers and detectives are often the gatekeepers who decide if a survivor is believable or if they think a rape occurred. So many cases are never heard by a grand jury or sent to a DA's office for review. And this becomes very problematic when you look at studies that show that many police officers have inherent bias against rape victims. It's sort of described as they presume a rape victim to be guilty to be proven, you know, innocent or telling the truth.
Right.
If I go out to the mall and I leave and come out to the parking lot and my car is stolen, I have full assurance that I can call the police and they'll come out and they'll treat me with dignity and respect and believe me that, you know, my car was stolen. And as a rape survivor, I can tell you that that is not necessarily the case when you call a police department to tell them, you know, that you were raped. And, you know, that's who we're told we go to for help. And it's very disheartening when you're disbelieved or treated with disrespect. In my case, I was treated in a very dismissive way. My rapist is well-known in the community and has connections and friends in city government and police departments, and I can't help but think that doesn't have something to do with it. So rape survivors often do not get justice, even when they're brave enough to come forward. And we need to hold police and governments accountable for timely processing of rape kits. We need to provide further education to police and detectives who are responsible for the fair and dignified treatment of victims, and educate the public who's going to serve on juries and hear these cases. And we also need to demand oversight, outside oversight of police departments who report unusually low numbers of sexual assaults because they're scrubbing numbers to make their cities look safer.
Absolutely.
Or mishandling sexual assault cases, you know.
Absolutely.
All those things need to happen.
You know, you make an excellent point in my investigative research. That sort of ties into, I think, these whole costs, these extra costs that are associated with the processing of the rape kit, as well as just gathering the evidence in the pelvic exam. I really believe if those costs were tied to the municipalities and the counties and the states where these actions occur, I bet to save money, all of a sudden they would start lowering the boom, and I bet more cases would be prosecuted and there wouldn't be backlogs of rape kits. You know, and what I also found in research is that there doesn't seem to be a disparity between urban areas and rural areas. A lot of the backup in even testing these kits. Now, we talked to our audience specifically about the drama and the, I think, the horrible situation of just getting the evidence. And once, you know, law enforcement has the evidence, there's a backlog in testing. I mean, here in Los Angeles, there's been cases of where either some municipalities have been either behind because of either man hours. Sometimes they have in-house testing and versus being able to send out outside testing. It's unacceptable. And then you have both state and federal politicians, specifically at the federal level, you know, the Violence Against Women's Act, which I know our listeners have heard at some point. That's actually, that piece of federal legislation was supposed to basically guarantee that a rape kit would be extended at no cost, as well as the cost associated with collecting the evidence, meaning the physician's fees. Well, sometimes, as I pointed out, the case in Louisiana, that didn't happen. And a lot of times it doesn't. And when you have someone who's gone through a traumatic event like that, you can't sit and tell someone, hey, wait a minute, I'm not supposed to pay for that. It's almost as if it's something that they should know, and it's something that should automatically happen. There should be some kind of trigger in terms of chain of custody of that evidence once it's collected, and even once it's reported and the individual is submitting to the exam, which I don't know why it would take 4 hours, you know, or the extended time that it takes to collect that information. But once I think a law enforcement agency is responsible for getting that information tested and getting that information loaded in DNA databases, I do think that for the public, they should actually know, and it should be reportable at how long it takes them to do that. And as a survivor, Dawn, do you have any thoughts at how that handles? And I also know that too, you have some expert medical expertise at understanding this too.
Yeah. Ironically, I was trained as a sexual assault nurse examiner. It's not something I did professionally because you have to be able to go at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is understandable. And I had a small child at the time, so I've been trained by the Attorney General's Office of Texas, so I know how this goes. And there is a chain of custody. You know, a kit is sealed. The nurse processes, you know, all the evidence, or obtains all the evidence, swabs, fingernail scrapings, everything, and puts it in the kit, and it's sealed, and it's actually handed over to a police detective or a police officer to be taken to an evidence room. And all of that evidence that has been sitting in collection rooms untested, you know, it degrades with time, it can mold. So these women and men have gone through this, you know, fairly traumatizing event, collecting all this evidence to just really have it dismissed. And the most, I think, horrendous thing I've learned about untested rape kits is when they finally do test them, the amount of hits they receive. In other words, they process DNA, they identify a rapist, and then that rapist goes on to match several other kits. So had they processed a kit in a timely manner, that might have prevented that rapist from going on to rape other people. Which brings me to a very important point, and that is that most men don't rape. They don't. You know, it's serial rapists who are responsible for the great number of rapes. You know, most rapists, when they're studied, you know, rape two times, four times, six times or more, they have multiple victims. And that illustrates why it's all the more important to process whatever evidence you have in a timely manner.
Excellent. What I want to talk about, Dawn, and to our audience, Dawn has created an organization, and she's currently building a coalition. And she's building a coalition of knowledgeable individuals, whether it's survivors or whether it's attorneys who are interested, and just everyday listeners like you who are listening to this show who want to get involved and start an education awareness program for the public at large, as well as for survivors. Dawn, can you tell us about what you have started?
Sure. On Facebook, I started a page that's called CARE, and that stands for Creating Awareness Through Rape Education. Unfortunately, Facebook will not let you use the word rape, so it's just creating awareness through education. And that's at, you know, www.facebook.com/carecontact. You can also email me at carecontactus or us@gmail.com. And, you know, the thing I identified, I've gone through a lot of stages, anger, sadness, all that, and I still get angry, but I really want to believe that most people care about this, that it's really going to take education. It's always disheartening when I read really horrible comments about rape victims and very judgmental comments. There's a lot of disbelief, natural disbelief of rape victims. And make no mistake, false accusations of rape are horrible. No one hates to hear about that sort of thing more than actual rape victims because it casts a light of disbelief on those of us who have actually experienced this. But I do think that there needs to be a lot of education about, you know, what rape is, that real rape can happen to anyone, victims range in age from infants to 95 years old, that it has nothing to do with what you wear, how you act, that it is always, always, always the fault of the rapist. And we need to change our attitude from giving victims a long list, or survivors, a long list of things that they shouldn't have done, or giving people a long list of things they shouldn't do to avoid being raped, rather than teaching men and boys that rape is wrong and not tolerating it. Because, you know, we can give all the mouth service in the world to, you know, that rape is wrong, you know, no means no. However, if we see a system where rape victims don't get justice, where they're dismissed, where they're disbelieved, where 98% of all rapists never see the inside of a jail cell, we are failing some of the most wronged people in our society. There are few crimes that are more horrific than having your body violated against your will. You know, we can have sex that we regret. Rape is not sex we regret. You know, all the myths of, you know, she regretted it, so then it became rape. Rape is rampant, not only on college campuses, but it can happen to anyone. It happened to me at the age of 49 years old because of my first rape at 18. I thought, if that ever happens to me again, I'm going to kill somebody. And that's not at all how I reacted. I froze. I totally shut down. There is no one right way to be or to react to being sexually assaulted. There is no one profile of a rape victim. There's no one profile of a rapist. Nice people can be rapists who seem perfectly normal on the outside. So there's a lot of education that needs to be done in society as a whole, in law enforcement, and in the courts. And as a final note, there needs to be cues taken, I think, from the civil rights movement, because this is a civil rights violation of mainly women. You know, the threat of rape inhibits our ability to go about our daily lives, to do what we need to do, you know, to have that in the back of your mind. And then if it, God forbid, does happen to you, to not receive justice. So, you know, I think if there are police departments or entities that are identified as systematically violating the rights of rape victims, there need to be class action lawsuits. I think that, you know, when rape victims get past the initial hurt and shock of being raped, not that you ever get over it, and when they find their voice, if they can, they need to be vocally outspoken and demand that this crime is prosecuted and that they receive the treatment they deserve as taxpayers and as citizens of this country.
Thank you, Dawn. That so well put. And also, we're kind of running out of time here. I just want to just wrap up here and let our audience know. I will have Dawn back because we're going to talk about the a process that her group CARE is going through, as well as we're going to talk again at a later date about the about our efforts to reach out to individuals in the public policy community. And I'll have those on as those individuals on as well. And we will definitely continue this series, but I'm glad we open up to address this subject. And also I want to thank our guest, Lisa Miller from Hope Rising. And definitely, ladies, thank you for joining me today. And just for our audience, you know, Dawn shared, you know, information just about the clinical part. And I shared some information about the clinical part, you know, with these victim assistance funds offered by these states. You know, the amount of money that's available doesn't even cover 100% the clinical part of the forensic evidence collection. There's also the mental health part. A lot of it, you know, they rely on a lot of these local charities and these local nonprofits. But there's a whole nother area along with that. And we want to start the dialogue here. And if you will, definitely get social with me on Facebook about this topic. Contact me on Twitter and Instagram about this topic, because we're gonna bring this up a little bit more. This is just phase one of taking on America's rape culture. And with that, I, you know, thank you to both my guests again for joining me today. And for those of you listening live today, thank you. And definitely we'll be right back here next week. Same time, same place. You can definitely join us.